his partner for more than 6 years. All those years, it was strictly platonic. A close relationship, sure, but not romantic, not sexual. But then there was the raid of the brownstone. Catherine was with him the night of the raid. Of course she was his partner. And afterward, she was in that room in the state's attorney's office when Amy accused the defendant of stealing the little black book. Catherine even knew that she might be under the umbrella of suspicion. Sure. Guilt by association, right? So, Catherine Fenton started looking into things on her own. And she began to believe that maybe her partner wasn't what he seemed. That maybe what Amy was saying was true. Maybe the defendant had stolen the little black book. Olson claps her hands together. And how did the defendant respond when he realized his partner was having second thoughts about him? She turns and looks at me. Same way he responded to Amy, she says. He seduced her. He started a romantic relationship. Also a very intense relationship. You will see and hear evidence that, at least to Catherine, the relationship grew very intense. Smart. Taking our defense and flipping it. Shoving it down our throats. But ultimately, his charms weren't enough, she says. Amy Lentini was a good prosecutor who kept investigating. Catherine Fenton was a good detective who kept investigating. As much as each of them cared for the defendant, the evidence against him was lining up. And finally, Detective Fenton confronted the defendant at Amy's apartment. You will see the last exchange of text messages between Catherine and the defendant only minutes before the defendant killed both women. Olson uses a fourth easel, next to the photographs of the three victims of my crimes, to post a blow-up of the message Kate had sent me. Fenton, need to talk to you. Harney, not now. Fenton, I'm right outside her door, open up. Harney, you're outside Amy's apartment? Fenton, yes, open door right now. Harney, why would I do that? Fenton, because she knows, you idiot. She knows about you, and so do I. State's Attorney Margaret Olson lets it all sink in, gives the jurors time to read the exchange on that poster board, watching their eyebrows arch and their mouths drop open as it all comes together for them. She knows, says Olson, drawing out the last words on that poster board. She knows about you, and so do I. The defendant was cornered by the two women he tried to distract, the two women he tried to charm into turning a blind eye to his crimes. He was cornered, and he had no other choice. He killed them both within minutes of each other. Now, let's talk about the physical evidence we will show you, she says. And there is plenty of it, but it's simply the icing on a delicious cake Margaret Olson has just baked. I can see from the way the jurors react to her words, from the nasty glances they shoot in my direction, that I already have one foot in the grave, and each juror is holding a shovel full of dirt. 88. The next morning, my lawyer, Stilson Tomita, gives our opening statement, just as he previewed it in his office. Kate was the classic woman scorned. There are 7 women on our jury, and my biggest concern is how it will play with them. Patty insists, and my wife once said the same thing to me, that nobody is more critical of women than other women. Maybe. But when the criticism comes from a man, I'm not so sure. Stilson uses the evidence he has, the sexy photos and the messages, including the implicit threat, you had your chance, remember that I gave you the chance. But they don't look convinced. They spent all last night thinking about what Margaret Olson said to them, that I was devious, manipulative, that I seduced Kate to keep an eye on her, to keep my enemy close. And every piece of evidence Stilson shows them, solidifying our claim that Kate had become irrational and desperate in her pursuit of me, is likewise more proof that my manipulation had worked. And then it's back to the prosecution. Margaret Olson parades in witnesses over the next 3 days, carefully building her case. Ngozi McNamara, an assistant state's attorney, a smartly dressed young African-American woman originally from Johannesburg, South Africa, who with that last name probably married an Irishman here in town. I assisted in preparing the complaint for the search warrant for the brownstone, she says. I did so at Amy Lentini's direction. Margaret Olson nods. And the first sentence of the third paragraph of that document, could you please read that into the record, Ms. McNamara? McNamara looks at her copy. The undersigned has been advised by a CI that handwritten records of the prostitution activity and the extortion payments made to Chicago police are contained within that residence. And what does CI mean? It means confidential informant. And under whose signature was this complaint going to be filed? Under Amy Lentini's, McNamara says. So Amy had a confidential informant? She did. Her informant told her that Ramona de la Vue was keeping a handwritten record book inside that brownstone. We were particularly interested in records of payoffs to the Chicago Police Department. Did Amy tell you the identity of her confidential informant? McNamara smiles at the memory, shakes her head. You couldn't have pried it out of her with the jaws of life. No? I mean, eventually she would have had to reveal the source to the judge issuing the search warrant. But until that moment, Amy would take it to her grave. Olson casts a look at the jury. And as far as you know, she did take it to her grave, didn't she? Police Superintendent Tristan Driscoll, my old pal, in full dress uniform, as if he's ever spent a day on the streets of this city getting his hands dirty. His chin raised, clearly and coherently explaining that Amy Lentini had become convinced that I had stolen the little black book after raiding the brownstone. Ms. Lentini made the obvious point that a homicide detective had no reason to be making an arrest for prostitution, he says. And I agreed. It made no sense. And how did the defendant respond? He became very agitated. Near the end of the conversation, he stormed out of his chair and got within inches of her. At first, I thought he was going to physically attack her. Objection, says Stilson, justifying his fat hourly rate. Move to strike. The judge strikes that last jab Tristan threw in. But how do you unring that bell? Pretend you didn't hear that, members of the jury, wink, wink, even though we all know you did. Mary Ann Lentini, Amy's mother, with many of those same dark features, tearfully recounting that her daughter came for a visit to Appleton, Wisconsin, and confided that she had met someone. Amy said that for the first time in her life, she found someone she could imagine a future with, says her mother. She said she was in love with a cop named Billy Harney. Mark Madison, an evidence technician for CPD, squat and thick, an unfortunate attempt at a dye job coloring the little bit of hair remaining on his head. I've known Mark for years. The last place he wants to be is on a witness stand testifying against me. He can't even bring himself to look in my direction. Yes, he says. I was present in the basement during the search of Billy's home. I did not personally find the weapon or weapons. But as one of the evidence technicians, was the discovery of the weapon called to your attention? Yes, ma'am. I was first called to a room in the basement that looked like a storage room. A firearm was found in a cigar box on one of the shelves. Is this the weapon you've just described? Olson says, showing him the gun in a clear bag. Yes, it is, says Mark. I bagged it and tagged it. I inventoried it, he says. Olson nods. What about other weapons? There was a knife, a regular old kitchen knife, discovered underneath the lid of the basement toilet, he says. I inventoried that too. Is this the kitchen knife? Another bag, holding the knife. Yes, it is. As far as you know, did you receive these weapons from the individual who discovered them? As far as I know, yes. And who was that? Olson asks. Who discovered the firearm and the kitchen knife in the defendant's basement? Was it the same person? It was the same person, says Mark. It was Lieutenant Paul Wisniewski. 89. Dr. Jacqueline Collins Lightford, a forensic scientist with the Chicago Police Crime Laboratory, a number of initials after a name, even more initials of the peer groups with which she's affiliated, fancy words and acronyms flying from all directions. By the time she explains all her credentials, we've covered the entire alphabet several times over. This witness is being handled by one of Olson's assistants, a prosecutor named Loretta Scopes, whom I've seen around the courthouse but never met. She looks the part. Serious, strident, no frills, just the facts. Doctor, how do you determine if there's blood on an item of evidence?
Two separate tests, she says. The first, a screening test, a preliminary test, if you will, is called the Ochterlony test, or OT for short. That test tells us whether the stain is blood, and if that test is positive, I'll do a hematrace test to confirm that the sample is blood and that its species origin is human. The prosecutor nods.
Did you perform those tests on People's Exhibit 4, this knife?
Yes.
And what were the results?
I did confirm the presence of blood, and the blood was human.
There goes our theory that the knife was used in the ritual sacrifice of a billy goat.
Doctor, did you collect a sample of that blood for DNA testing?
Yes.
Did you also prepare a blood sample obtained from the victim, Ms. Ramona Delavue, via search warrant for DNA testing?
I did.
Did you compare these samples?
Yes.
How did you do that?
That answer basically takes up most of an afternoon.
Everybody knows what DNA is, but then again, nobody does. Only people in lab coats really get it. The processes, the intertwined sciences, the flaws. So one of these witnesses takes the stand and provides a 90-minute tutorial on DNA analysis, throws out phrases like short tandem repeats and amplified fragment-length polymorphism and polymerase chain reaction. And we pretend that these jurors could possibly understand what the hell is going on. Would we let a juror perform cardiovascular surgery after a two-hour class? Would we let a juror inspect the ears of a dog based on that training? Hell no. But do we let a juror find someone guilty of murder and send him away for the rest of his life after a crash course in deoxyribonucleic acid fingerprinting? Sure, no problem. The punchline from Dr. Collins Lightford. The blood on the knife found in my basement was consistent with that of Ramona Delavue and would be consistent with only one in 3.6 quadrillion white females. Since there aren't 3.6 quadrillion white females living on this planet, it sounds like a match for Ramona Delavue's blood. The juror in the far left corner, a retired physics professor, seems to be thinking the same thing as he shoots a frosty look in my direction. Ballistics comes next. A forensic scientist with the Illinois State Police named Spencer Lipscomb.
Grooves are the spiral cuts made in the barrel of a firearm at the time of manufacture, says Lipscomb. Grooves are cut into the barrel with a spiral direction, either to the left or right. The purpose is to put a spin on the bullet and aid its stability in flight. The uncut surface inside the barrel is called the land. When a bullet is discharged through the barrel, the lands and grooves will impress themselves on the bullet. So a bullet exhibiting five lands and grooves with a left twist couldn't be fired from a weapon, for example, that has six lands and grooves and a right twist.
Sure.
We call these rifling characteristics.
Okay. Did you find that the bullets recovered in the shooting of Amy Lentini and Catherine Fenton contained rifling characteristics consistent with the service weapon registered to and owned by the defendant?
Yes.
So what did you do next?
I examined the striations on the surface of the projectile. Scratches, basically. If you look at the surface of a barrel under high magnification, you see that it resembles the edge of a saw. These microscopic protrusions make contact with the bullet and cause microscopic scratches. So if you have the weapon, as we do, you test fire a bullet and compare its striations under high magnification to the bullets found at the scene of the crime. Basically, you compare the bullets to see if they have the same scratches.
And did they?
Yes.
So, what did you conclude? He concludes that my gun was used to shoot Amy and Kate. We retained an expert to do his own test, and he came to the same conclusion. And what about the bullet that killed Detective Joe Washington, Doctor? Did you test that bullet to determine whether it was fired from the weapon found in the defendant's basement? He did, of course. And he reached the same conclusion. The gun discovered in my basement was used to kill Camel Coat. Again, our expert doesn't disagree, so we won't fight it. So my gun killed Kate and Amy. We already know that. The knife found in my basement killed Ramona De La Vue, and the gun found in my basement killed Camel Coat. But that doesn't mean I was the one who used those weapons. We could offer up more than one person who might have done so and then stashed the weapons in my basement. One of them is Kate, who is dead. Another is the person who discovered those weapons in my basement, and he is very much alive. The people call Lieutenant Paul Wisniewski, says Margaret Olson. 90. Please state your name and spell your last name for the record. That's W-I-Z. He should stop there. Everybody calls me the Wiz, he should say, but it's not meant as a compliment. Most people think I'm a self-righteous dick. The first topic, the raid of the brownstone. Olson gets to it quickly. I tried to impress on Detective Harney, Wisniewski says, that it was very odd for a homicide detective to bust up a house of prostitution. We have Vice for that. I told him he should call in Vice. He shouldn't do it himself. Bullshit. Wisniewski's only objection was that the people inside were major players like the mayor and the archbishop, meaning that there could be political blowback for me, and more important, for him. And how did the defendant respond? Asks Margaret Olson. The Wiz takes a breath and turns to the jury. He made it very clear that it had to be him who did it, and it had to be that night. Did the defendant say why it was so important that he personally conduct the raid? Or why it was so important that he do so that night? No, he did not. It made no sense. Olson nods, pauses, looks at her shoes. This brownstone he was talking about raiding, she says. Was this the first time this brownstone had come to your attention? No, it was not, he says. I sit forward in my seat, something catching in my throat. I believe that this brownstone was being protected, he says. I was investigating the possibility that Chicago police officers were engaged in a protection racket. I look at Stilson. First I've heard of this. Stilson sees my look and writes on a piece of paper, taps the words with his pencil. No emotion. And the target of my investigation was Detective Billy Harney, he says. I bite down on my lip, turn my head away. So I was investigating my boss, while he was investigating me, while the Cook County State's Attorney's Office was investigating all of us? You need a Venn diagram to keep track. For the last 18 months, he says, Detective Harney had been pulling old arrest reports. It wasn't part of any active investigation. It certainly had nothing to do with homicide. Right, because I was investigating you, Wiz. I was pulling all the arrest reports in cases where people seemed to magically escape prosecution, many times finding that the chain of command ended with you. And I was doing it surreptitiously, you prick, because I was undercover for internal affairs. I believe these were records of people he was protecting, says Wisniewski. People arrested for various offenses who were released before referral to the state's attorney. People who got sprung right away for no apparent reason. They were records of people you were protecting, Wisniewski. Feeling my blood boil, my legs bouncing under the table. My lawyer tapping those words on the page again. No emotion. I'm confused, Lieutenant, says Margaret Olson, who is anything but confused. Why would he pull arrest records that show his corruption? The Wiz nods. See, when you pull old arrest reports, it generates a record. You have to sign them in and out. It's right there on the jacket of the file. You have to put your name and star number next to each request, and you can see who else has made a request. You can see all previous requests? Yeah, of course. You can see the entire list of people who have requested these records before you. Olson nods. So do several jurors, for whom the picture is becoming clearer.
I believe Detective Harney was pulling these reports to see if anybody else had been pulling these reports, says the Wiz. He wanted to know if anybody was on to him.
Brilliant. I can't deny it. My teeth grinding together, my hands and fists, sitting in a courtroom, having to stay composed while fireworks go off inside me. But brilliant. Wisniewski is using my undercover investigation against me, to make me look like the guilty party.
Stilson leans into me, out of character for him.
You have got to keep a lid on yourself, he whispers, each word like a dart.
Did you report your suspicions to the higher-ups? Olson asks.
I did, sort of, he says. I had a conversation with the head of internal affairs, Lieutenant Michael Goldberger.
I turn back to the Wiz, catch my breath.
Internal affairs? Is that in your chain of command?
He lifts his shoulders. From time to time, I've passed on information, let's put it that way.
I didn't officially work for IA, if that's what you mean.
All right. So, did you go to Lieutenant Goldberger's office?
Oh, no, nothing like that. We're at one of the copper bars, the hole in the wall off Rockwell.
Tell us about the conversation.
The Wiz says, I threw it out there. I said I'd been wondering about Billy Harney, why he always seemed to disappear on the job and seemed to be nosing around in places where his nose didn't belong, nothing to do with solving murders.
And what did Lieutenant Goldberger say, if anything?
Oh, he shut me down right away. He told me Billy Harney was a righteous cop. He said he's known him his whole life, and Billy was straight as an arrow.
That's my Goldie. But Olson doesn't want the image of me as a good cop lingering for too long.
Lieutenant Goldberger has known the defendant his whole life?
Yeah, thick as thieves, those two, like a second father. So I knew right then that Goldberger would be no help to me. He was biased.
Olson opens her hands.
So what did you do?
I went to the only place I could, he says. I went to the state's attorney's office.
He went to the...
I was Amy Lentini's confidential informant, he says.
91. The screen comes alive, a fuzzy black and white video of the subway tunnel.
This individual here, says Wisniewski, standing away from the witness stand and using a pointer, is Billy Harney.
It shows me acting like I'm waiting for the subway, like everyone else.
And this gentleman approaching in the beige coat,
I prefer camel coat,
is Detective Joe Washington.
And where were you, Lieutenant, at the time?
I was across the tracks on the other side, trying to conceal my face, trying to watch them without them knowing.
You followed the defendant to this location?
Yes, I did.
So what happened next?
Well, as you can see,
Wisniewski narrates for the written record, but the jury doesn't need his words. They can see it for themselves.
The screen shows Camel Coat approaching me and stopping, without any acknowledgement between us. Just two guys waiting for the train. I'm on the phone, a fake phone call, and then I turn my back to the camera and to Camel Coat.
Then, as we had rehearsed ahead of time, Camel Coat sneezes, and he too turns his back to Wisniewski in the camera, both our backs turned. Then an envelope passing from Camel Coat to me.
Olson freezes the screen there, so that the image sticks with the jury.
Wisniewski returns to the witness stand.
Do you know what information Detective Washington passed to the defendant?
Asks Margaret Olson.
No, I very much wanted to know. I already suspected that Harney was covering his tracks, and now he was secretly meeting with someone from internal affairs.
Right, because we were trying to flush you out, Wisniewski. We were trying to flush out my tail, the person who'd been following me. The whole thing in the subway was a ruse, intended to look like a surreptitious meeting so we could catch my tail. But to the jury, it looks like I really was meeting secretly with Camel Coat.
Once again, the Wiz has turned my undercover work against me, making me look guilty instead of him. He has played this brilliantly.
Lieutenant, did you ever find out what was inside the envelope that Detective Washington handed the defendant on that subway platform?
No, I did not.
Why not?
Because later that night, Joe Washington was murdered.
He turns and looks at me,
an icy stare. By a gun we later found in Billy Harney's basement.
I return his stare. I still don't remember what happened the night that Kate and Amy and I were shot, or for 2 weeks before that time. But I don't need to. Not anymore. He knew I was investigating him. He needed to stop me. What better way than to turn the tables? He became Amy Lentini's confidential informant. He got them to start investigating me, and then he set me up for murder. It was Wisniewski all along. All of it. But I can't prove it, and now it's too late.
Your Honor, says Margaret Olson, the prosecution rests.
92. I lie in bed, curtains pulled tightly closed, dark as ink in my bedroom. Squeezing my eyes shut, begging for sleep, pleading for peace, praying that the demons will quiet their devious cries, that the dread filling my chest will ease, that my breathing will return to normal. My body utterly depleted, desperate for rest, but my brain malfunctioning, as though wires have been crossed, thoughts still careening about, memories and fantasies, flashbacks and concoctions, fact and fiction. The past rushing forward to the present and mixing together like dirt and water, an indiscernible sludge. She knows about you, and so do I. You had your chance. Remember that I gave you the chance. Stuart, patting my shoulder in the ICU. Amy, laughing, a ghoulish, clownish expression. You shot me, Billy. You killed me, and you don't even remember.
Wisniewski, talking me out of raiding the brothel. You fuck this up, it could be the last arrest you ever make. I was Amy Lentini's confidential informant.
The knife found in my basement, used to kill Ramona De La Vue. The gun found in my basement, used to kill Camel Coat. A door opening, a soft click, a release of pressure like a gentle sigh. Kate's head whipping to the right, surprised, then not surprised, nodding. What are you doing here? A door opening, a soft click. Kate's head whipping to the right. A door opening, a soft click, the whiny groan of an old door. A door my wife thought was charming when we first moved in, but that she later begged me to replace because of all the noise it made. The back door of my townhouse. My eyes open now. No more dreams. Now reality. Somebody's in my house. All senses on high alert. My heart thumping so hard it might burst out of my body and smack against the ceiling, raining down blood and tissue. I reach for my gun on the nightstand. Feel relief when my fingers brush against the cold, smooth polymer frame. I grip it in my hand, curl my finger around the trigger. I slip off my bed, my foot lowering gently to the soft rug, my body weight slowly transferring downward until I'm in a crouch. The image is still bombarding me, the echoes of noise and human voices. Amy, you can trust me, Billy. I have the little black book.
Patty, there is no little black book.
Kate, she knows about you, and so do I. Footsteps. A groan on the floorboard near the staircase. He's coming upstairs. Kate's head whipping to the right, surprised. Then not surprised. Nodding. What are you doing here? There is no little black book. I have the little black book. No, I whisper to myself, shaking my head. No, 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 no. It's not that you can't remember. You don't want to remember. My body inching forward along the rug, my weight quietly shifting, nudging forward like a caterpillar in the darkness of my bedroom. The soft tap of a footstep. Holding my breath now, my gun poised in front of me, my hands trembling, sweat dripping off my face, into my eyes, my skin on fire. The soft tap. Each step a negotiation with the floorboards in the hallway. He's getting close now. A rush of white noise between my ears, a freight train of pressure.
No,
I whisper so quietly that the air barely escapes my mouth. The figure appears in the doorway, dim light from a hallway window framing the vague outline of a man. A man looking into the pitch darkness of my bedroom. Dark turtleneck. Ski mask. Stranger danger. His foot planting on the bedroom carpet, feeling emboldened. Easier to walk on carpet than on hardwood. Two confident steps, then raising his gun and aiming it at the bed, toward the pillow where my head would normally lie. Pause. His eyes adjusting to the darkness. Something wrong. His target isn't there. Just like that, he spins in my direction in the corner. Kate's head whipping to the right. What are you doing here? I squeeze the trigger once, twice, three times. Tiny muzzle flashes, little bursts of fire interrupting the darkness. 4, 5, 6. I don't stop until the magazine is empty. Return fire from his gun, muzzle flashes far bigger, clouds of orange dancing downward in the blackness like falling comets, until stranger danger smacks the floor and lies still. I drop my Glock and brace myself, my fingers digging into the carpet as if holding on for dear life against a tidal wave of memories. Memories, not dreams. Memories. Vivid and specific. Sights and sounds and smells, fear and hatred and pure horror, knocking me this way and that, stealing my breath, sending fire through my chest. I find my oxygen, taking in delicious breaths and deep gulps, wheezing, gagging, unable to speak. And when words return to me, all I can say is no. No, 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 no! 93. The fog lifted, replaced with white noise, the buzz of evidence technicians and police officers milling about. Let's get you out of here. Patty, a hand under my armpit, pulling me up. Let them do their work. We step carefully around stranger danger, lying still on my bedroom carpet, the 45 still in his hand, his black sweater ripped open with bloody holes. His ski mask raised to his forehead. A white male, late 20s or early 30s. A day's growth on his face, a scar along the cheek, vacant eyes staring upward. He was dead before he hit the carpet. We'll get his ID, Patty says. I'm sure he has a sheet. My father and Goldie standing in the hallway as the evidence technicians do their work inside the bedroom and along the hallway, tagging and photographing and dusting. Pop has his arm out as I approach, taking me in a half hug, Patty on my other side, the two of them propping me up like I was an invalid. We go downstairs into the family room. A detective takes my statement. I don't have much to tell him. I heard the rear door open, I hid in the corner of my bedroom, I unloaded on the intruder. An intruder I've never seen before. My two brothers, Aiden and Brendan, who've come into town for the trial, try to fix the locks that have been busted tonight. The one on my back door, which was removed by the intruder, and the one on the front door, which the responding officers busted through. My lawyer, Stilson Tomita, arrives a couple of hours into it, finding Patty and me on the couch. My father and Goldie, talking to the responding detectives about the investigation and demanding round-the-clock protection for me. Through it all, I sit on the couch with my head back on the cushion, my eyes closed. People are speaking quietly around me, assuming I'm asleep, hoping I'm asleep, that I'm having a few moments of peace. But I'm not asleep, and I'm not at peace. I'm thinking. Thinking about what happened upstairs. Not stranger danger, not the shooting. No, I'm thinking about the thoughts and images that came before him and after him, the ones that steamrolled me, that took my breath away. Now they have hardened, turned to ice, forming solid, jagged blocks inside my chest. Billy, Stilson says softly, nudging me. I raise my head and open my eyes. Behind Stilson, through the window, the first sign of sunrise. Lazy, blurry light. We'll get a continuance, Stilson says. After what just happened to you, the judge will grant it. No, I say. You need to rest, Patty says. Listen, here's the other thing, Stilson says. I know what happened tonight was terrible, but we can use it. It shows that somebody wants to keep you quiet. I look at Patty and start to push myself off the couch. Where are you going?
I'm gonna take a shower and get dressed for court, I say.
Patty and Stilson say, whoa, 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 as if in sync. Stilson steps in front of me, blocking me.
Billy, it had to be Wisniewski. This is all Wisniewski.
I nod at him, pat his shoulder.
But we need time, he says. We need time to prove it, to put it all together. After what just happened here, we can make the case for more time.
I push past him. I don't need any more time, I say.
Billy, you're not right, says Patty. You can't go to court like this. You can't testify like this. How are you going to testify?
I turn and look at my twin sister, the person who knows me better than anybody. I thought I knew her better than anybody. I thought we trusted each other.
Stilson, you need to get home and shower. See you at the courthouse.
I raise a hand as Patty and Stilson protest, and I walk away and head upstairs to shower and change. Today, in just a few short hours, I will testify at my trial, and I will tell the truth.
94.
2 hours later, I'm in court. Everyone looks surprised to see me. They've all heard what happened in my house last night. The judge tells Stilson that he will give us a continuance. I instruct Stilson to say no. The judge presses Stilson, makes him affirmatively waive the court's generous offer of a continuance so the judge can protect his record on appeal.
He wants to testify now, Judge,
says Stilson, shrugging.
Against my advice,
he adds, protecting his own record. I walk up to the witness stand, my legs wobbly, my body trembling. But my mind, for the first time in a very long time, is clear as day.
Do you solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do. I will tell the truth. I will testify truthfully that I didn't remember anything about what happened in the bedroom with Kate and Amy. And then I will testify truthfully that I remember now. It all came back. It all came back when I heard my back door creak open, when I listened to a man sneak up the stairs and tiptoe down the hallway to kill me. The chaos, the terror, the adrenaline. It didn't just unlock the door in my brain. It barreled through it, ripping it from its hinges. I remember everything.
Mr. Harney, says Stilson, you stand accused of killing 4 people.
Yes.
Mr. Harney, did you kill those 4 people?
No, I say. I didn't kill Ramona Delavue. I didn't kill Joe Washington. I didn't kill Kate, and I didn't kill Amy. I look at Patty, sitting in the front row, straight as an arrow, holding her breath. This is not going to be easy for her. I didn't kill those people, I say, but I know who did.
Past and present. 95. The present.
Stilson Tomita flips through his notes, trying to keep up with me. It's not his fault. He didn't know what I was going to say today. Hell, I didn't know what I was going to say today until a few hours ago, when it all came rushing back. The jurors, even after a full morning of testimony in which I recounted every detail leading up to the murders, are listening with rapt attention, leaning forward, eyes narrowed. As is everyone else. The media, furiously taking notes and typing on their phones, tweeting out revelations drip by drip. My sister, wound tight, looking as if she hasn't taken a breath for 3 hours.
So someone left a photograph on your doorstep of Amy Lentini walking up the steps to the brownstone, says Stilson, repeating the last thing I said.
This is the best he can do to keep this in Q&A format, as opposed to just letting me talk nonstop for hours on end.
So, what happened next?
Well, after I saw that photo, which had the same angle, the same positioning, the same everything as the photos Kim Beans had been publishing every week in her online column, it seemed clear to me that it was taken by the same person who was slipping Kim those photographs.
So what did you do?
I confronted Amy. I asked her what the heck was going on.
And what did she say?
Asks Stilson, as curious as the jury.
She told me about the investigation, I say.
She finally told me that the state's attorney's office was investigating the possibility that the brownstone was making payoffs to Chicago cops for protection. And whoever had left that photo of Amy at my doorstep was probably the same person who had been slipping the photographs to Kim Beans for her weekly column. But I asked myself, who would leak those photographs to a reporter? And then I finally realized why someone would do that. When did you realize that? When Margaret Olson announced her candidacy for mayor. Maximum Margaret, posture already erect, seems to steel herself all the more. Hands flat on the table, about to rise and object. Behind her, the spectators buzz, low mumbles of surprise. The sheriff's deputy barks out a call for order in the courtroom. Congressman Tedesco was the presumed frontrunner for the mayoral job, I say. He had a lot of money and everyone's support. It would have been his job for the taking. And suddenly, he drops out and endorses the state's attorney? I mean, come on. Your Honor, object to relevance and speculation, says Margaret Olson. Stilson, bless his heart, does his best, even though he's winging it. He's explaining the course of his investigation, Judge. He's not saying it was true. Yes, I am, I say. The judge and Stilson glare at me. The testimony is permissible as far as it relates to what the defendant suspected and how it affected his investigation, says the judge, a brittle old guy named Bradford Beatty. It is not to be considered something the defendant knew for a fact. And Mr. Tomita, the judge adds, wagging a finger, assert some control here or I will. Even a defendant testifying to his theory of innocence has his limits. Anyway, I say, that's what I was thinking. That the state's attorney was using these photos to blackmail Congressman Tedesco. She had a photo of him, because the congressman was a client of the Brownstone brothel. Okay, says Stilson. So what? So I tailed the reporter, Kim Beans, in order to discover her source. For 3 days, I stayed on her. I even saw her wait for several hours at a restaurant, the Twisted Spoke, where it sure seemed like she was waiting for someone. But nothing came of it. The source never showed. I nod my head. The source knew I was tailing Kim. Someone had tipped off the source. But that didn't make sense to me. The only person in the world who knew I was tailing Kim, besides me, was Amy. Stilson's chin rises. Okay, so what happened? So naturally, that made me suspicious of Amy, I continue. Because Amy was a top aide to Margaret Olson. She was her number two. Amy had sworn to me up and down that Margaret Olson had no designs on the mayoral job. And then suddenly I'm watching the state's attorney announcing her candidacy for mayor. I didn't know what to think. Stilson nods, waits to see if I have anything else to say. Lawyers like to prepare well in advance, rehearse and re-rehearse for testimony like this. Stilson doesn't have the slightest idea what will come next. He's been relegated to asking the basic, what happened next, question so many times that the jurors could ask it for him. So what happened next, Billy? That day, the day that Margaret Olson announced her candidacy for mayor, nothing happened, I say. I was just in a fog. I didn't know whom to trust, whom to believe, whom to suspect. I nod to Stilson to indicate I'm done. A little signal we seem to have informally worked out. What about the next day? Stilson, and presumably the jurors, know that the next day was the day that Amy and Kate were murdered. The next day, I say, Amy called me and asked me to come to her apartment. 96. The Past. I drove to Amy's condo, the traffic heavy, talk radio breathlessly discussing the new revelation in the Chicago mayoral race. Congressman Tedesco had bowed out. State's attorney Margaret Olson was now the frontrunner. The announcement had been made yesterday, and it had thrown me just as it had thrown the media, but for different reasons. I wanted so badly to confront Amy about it, but I hadn't reached out to her, not yesterday. I needed time to process it. She'd promised me that Margaret had no desire to run, and suddenly she was running, with Tedesco's blessing, with his endorsement. It all pointed to Amy and Margaret from the beginning. The reason they were so sensitive about the little black book. The reason that somebody had been slipping Kim Beans those photographs of the brothel's clientele. It had been a veiled warning to Congressman Tedesco that his photograph could be next if he didn't behave like a good little boy. And if it was true, it was brilliant. They'd taken down the mayor and blackmailed his would-be replacement so that Margaret could have the job all to herself. I thought about it all last night. I thought about it all day today at work. It meant that the Amy I knew wasn't the Amy I knew. It meant that the Amy I knew was capable not only of blackmail, but also of murder. "I need to talk to you," Amy had said over the phone 5 minutes ago. That was it, nothing else. I'd protested, thrown out some sarcastic remark, but all she kept repeating was, "I need to talk to you." And the reason I went to her apartment? The reason I didn't just punch off the phone and cuss at her or accuse her? Simple. Because I wasn't ready to believe any of it. Because I wanted to believe that the Amy I knew really was the Amy I knew. "I'll be right over," I told her. It wasn't the smart play. I had no element of surprise on my side. I didn't know what was waiting for me at her apartment. I was falling straight into whatever trap she had set. I pulled up to her apartment building and walked up to her front door under the awning outside. I knew this building well enough. There were other ways in. There was an underground parking lot serviced by an elevator that went straight up past the lobby. There was a back door by the garbage bins, too. There was a stairwell if you wanted to avoid elevators. There were surreptitious means of access if you needed them. I could picture myself doing it. Slipping in one of the other entrances, picking the lock on her door, and employing at least some element of surprise. Not a lot, but a little. But I didn't, because I had made a choice. A choice to give Amy the benefit of the doubt. I pushed the buzzer, and a voice came through the speaker. "It's me," I said. The buzzer came next, the front door releasing pressure with a soft whoosh. I opened the door, walked through the foyer, and took the elevator up to her floor. I walked down the empty hallway, reached her door, stopped and listened, then rapped my knuckles against the door. She opened the door a crack, those angelic eyes peering at me, and darting around, looking to see whether I was alone. I was alone. My weapon was loaded and secure, but I was alone. I didn't know if I could say the same for her. 97. Amy opened the door a crack and backed away from it. I walked in and closed the door behind me. I didn't lock it. You never know when a quick exit might be necessary. I threw off my winter coat and tossed it, leaving me in my sport jacket and blue jeans, what I wore to work today. Amy took another step back. "Where is it?" she said to me, her voice trembling. I didn't catch her meaning. "The little black book," she said. "Where is it?" I shook my head. "Seems like we're right back where we started, Amy."
"That's not an answer."
"Me first," I said. "My question first." She didn't like it, narrowed her eyes. Hurt, confusion, maybe fear across her face. "Why didn't Kim Sauce show up this week?" I asked. "Kim went to the meeting place to get a weekly incriminating photograph. I watched her, but the source never showed. Why didn't the source show?" Amy cocked her head at me.
"How should I know?"
I walked over to the breakfast bar by our small kitchen, ran my hands underneath it, picked up the sugar bowl resting on it and looked inside it, felt behind the photograph of Amy and her parents posing on a beach somewhere warm. Did the same thing in the rest of her kitchen. The counters, the coffee pot, the spice bottles, the cookbooks. Felt my hands around and inside everything, like it was foreplay.
"What are you doing?"
Amy asked. "Somebody tipped off Kim Sauce," I said as I ran my hand over the top of the refrigerator. "The source knew I'd be watching." Amy gave me a wide berth as I passed her and walked over to the couch, giving it a once-over with my hands, feeling the cushions and pillows, picking up the flower vase and emptying out the fake flowers, then returning them to the vase. Looking at each of the framed photographs on the coffee table, feeling each of them.
"Oh, I get it," said Amy. "The only person who knew you were following Kim was me. So I must have tipped off Kim's source. Which means I knew who the source was in the first place. Which means I'm behind this whole thing."
I looked at Amy, saw the hurt in her eyes. the woman I loved with all my heart, the woman I wasn't sure I could trust. It was like I'd stolen the wind from her. She remained silent. A long moment passed. I didn't want to believe it. I wanted to trust her so badly my bones ached. Neither of us knew what to say. It was so quiet in the room that I heard the tick of the clock on the wall behind me as the minute hand inched forward. I turned and looked at it. An ornate little clock hanging on the wall. It had a picture of a rooster on its small porcelain face and Roman numerals in a fancy font. I walked over to the clock, reached up to it with both hands, my jacket hiking up accordingly. "You brought your gun," Amy said, seeing the holster. I pulled the clock off the wall, gently lifting the wire over the nail. A decorative piece, a French country design that fit the decor of the place, running on a battery. I flipped it over and found it. A small, square thingamajig. Even if it were seen, and it was never supposed to be seen, it could pass as some kind of battery compartment or something. A bug, a wireless recording device. I suddenly hated myself. Amy wasn't the only one who knew I was tailing Kim. Whoever was on the other end of this eavesdropping device heard our whole conversation when we hatched the plan right here in this room. That person heard a lot of other conversations, too. I removed the bug from the back of the clock and held it in the palm of my hand. Amy's eyes widened when she saw it. She knew what it was. She'd been a federal prosecutor for years, and the feds love these things. She frowned, put a hand to her chest. The realization dawning on her that someone had invaded her privacy, that someone was listening to everything she said in this apartment. I dropped the bug on the floor and crushed it with my boot. "I'm so sorry," I said. "I should have trusted you." I started toward her. I thought of touching her, embracing her, caressing her, but I could see how cold she was, how unsure. We were still negotiating a truce. I had just figured out what I came here to learn. I had answered my question. But Amy still had a question for me. She was still a few steps away from fully trusting me. "If you trust me now," she said, "then why do you still need your gun?" I nodded, reached behind my back and removed my firearm, held it with my thumb and index finger, the weapon dangling upside down, and placed it on the coffee table near her. She looked at it, then looked at me. Then in one movement, she took a step backward and picked up the gun, holding it awkwardly in her hands, pointing it at me. "Okay, now back to my question," she said. "Where's the little black book?" 98. Amy, still spooked by the recording device I'd found in the living room, probably worried that there was more than one in that room, motioned me toward the bedroom. She made me go first, keeping her distance, still aiming my gun at me. When we reached the bedroom, Amy looked around. She had the same thought I did. This room could be bugged, too. She walked over to an iPad resting on the windowsill and pushed a button. Some music came on. Symphony music, strings. She turned it up. It was loud enough to run some interference, but not so loud that we couldn't talk. Amy fixed the gun on me again. It was time to get back to business, though the way she held the gun made me think it might have been her first time handling a weapon. "I had a copy of the little black book," she said to me. You had a copy of it all along? And you..." "Not all along," she said. "I got it yesterday, after your sister Patty paid me a visit at my office." She laid it out for me. Yesterday, after Margaret Olson had announced her candidacy for mayor, Patty confronted Amy as she was leaving the Daily Center. "Patty explained her whole theory," she said, "that Margaret was blackmailing Congressman Tedesco, that Margaret had a copy of the little black book, and it named Tedesco as a client. Maybe she even had one of those incriminating photographs of Tedesco going into the brownstone, like the other ones Kim Beans published. That the whole thing was a scheme so Margaret could remove the mayor from office and take his place, with Tedesco not only getting out of her way, but also actually endorsing her and giving her his money." "Sounds right to me," I said. Obviously not to Amy. "You didn't want to believe it," I said, "but you couldn't deny that it made some sense." Amy nodded with reluctance. "Right. So I went back up to Margaret's office. I have a key.
There's a safe under her desk. It's been there since the 1970s, when whoever was state's attorney wanted to keep some sensitive papers private or something. Anyway, nobody knew about the safe but Margaret and me.
You broke into it, I said.
I knew the combination. She opened it in front of me once. She was running late for a refinance, and the closing papers were in there. I didn't mean to pay attention, but she sort of sang out the number to herself, and I heard it. 92160, 92160. It's her sister's date of birth, September 21st, 1960. The music from the iPad, violins and cellos, the notes dancing about, rising and falling in crisp, short strokes, adding a dreamlike quality to the whole thing. You opened it, I said, and you found the little black book.
I found a thumb drive. I brought it back here and booted it up on my home computer last night, and yes, she said, it contained a PDF of the little black book.
She swept a hand.
And now it's gone. It was inside my desk drawer last night, and now it's not. Somebody broke into my apartment today and stole it.
That was a concern, a major one, but there were more immediate concerns on my mind.
Amy, I said, was Congressman Tedesco's name in there as a client?
Amy closed her eyes and nodded.
Yes.
So Margaret was blackmailing him.
She didn't answer. She didn't need to.
Did the little black book list payoffs to cops?
Amy nodded, her eyes moving away from mine.
One cop, she said. One name over and over, once a month, for the last 3 years.
99. I felt something stir inside me. It was what we had thought, that the real value and the real danger of the little black book lay not in the names of the clients, but in the name of the crooked cop who was receiving extortion payments from the brownstone. The name of the cop was in that book.
What name? I asked. Which cop?
And then I felt a buzz in my pocket. I pulled out my phone. It was a text message from Kate.
Need to talk to you.
Now was definitely not the time. I texted back, not now. I lowered the phone and looked at Amy.
So whose name was it? I asked.
Amy didn't want to answer.
Amy, I said. Whoever's name is in that little black book is probably the same person who bugged your apartment. It's probably the same person who stole the little black book from your apartment today. It's probably the same person behind all of this.
Amy nodded slowly, as if she already had figured that out.
How long before they come here looking for you? I said.
My phone buzzed again. I raised the phone to see Kate's next message. I'm right outside her door, open up.
Shit. I lowered the phone. It's Kate. She's out in the hallway right now.
Amy's eyes widened in panic.
Kate's here? You brought her here?
She backpedaled, the gun trembling in her hands, as if her worst fears had just been realized.
No, I didn't. She must have followed me or something.
Oh, shit. Oh, God. Oh, shit.
Amy's eyes cast about the room. She was coming unglued. She had the gun on me, not the other way around, but she was feeling a loss of control, and her fear was overtaking her.
I'll try to get rid of her. I typed a quick response.
You're outside Amy's apartment? Her reply shot back in an instant.
Yes, open door right now.
I replied, trying to stall for time.
Why would I do that?
But I was running out of time. Kate wasn't going to take no for an answer. She'd break through the door. She could do it, and she'd be armed.
Amy, give me the gun, I said, reaching out my hand, wiggling my fingers.
Amy shook her head furiously, but I could see her uncertainty, wanting to believe me, but afraid of being wrong.
Amy, like it or not, Kate's coming in and she'll have a gun. You don't know how to use that thing.
No.
Amy's face contorted, tears flowing, her voice thick with emotion, that gun dancing around in her hands.
No!
Amy, you can trust me. You can...
I stopped on those words. My phone buzzed again, another text from Kate, but I didn't look at it. I watched Amy carefully. I could see that Amy simply didn't, couldn't trust me.
Whose name was in that black book? I asked. Whose name was listed as receiving the payoffs? The music through the speakers, one song coming to a violent, triumphant climax of violin and cello, another song beginning, the bass playing solo, moving slowly and cautiously, like a snake through the grass, a warning of a storm. All that was missing was a drum roll. Your name, Amy said. It was your name in the little black book. What? My phone fell out of my hands. On impact with the carpet, the face of my phone lit up, showing the last message from Kate, which I had yet to read. I picked it back up to make sure I read it correctly. Because she knows, you idiot. She knows about you, and so do I. Then I remembered that I never locked Amy's front door after entering. And then I turned and saw Kate walking into the apartment, her weapon drawn. 100. Kate, take it easy, I called as she walked toward the bedroom. I held out my right hand as a signal to stop. I held out my left to Amy. Amy, I said, give me the gun. No. Amy shook her head, steeled herself through her tears, aimed the gun toward the doorway into the bedroom. Amy, I know how to use that thing. You don't. You'll get us all killed. Kate approached with her weapon in both hands, held it waist level in front of her, walking on the balls of her feet. She could hear what I was saying. She knew Amy had a gun now. As Kate approached, I moved into the space between Amy and the doorway, where Kate now stood with her weapon aimed at Amy, and by extension at me. Amy! Kate barked. Drop that gun or I'll put you down. Drop it right now or I'll shoot. The way she said it, I'd heard that voice before. That no fucking around tone. Amy was a prosecutor, not a cop. She wasn't cut out for this. Do it, Amy, I said, remaining between them. But it wouldn't matter. If Kate wanted to shoot Amy, she would. Then I heard it behind me. The sound of the gun releasing from Amy. The soft plunk as it fell onto the nearby bed. I saw it in Kate's eyes, too. That hint of relaxation. But only a hint. Kate was keyed up, her eyes on fire. Amy wasn't sobbing anymore either. I had my back to her, but I knew she was no longer upset. The only emotion she was experiencing now was pure terror. Both of you, against that wall! Kate motioned with the gun. We complied, moving to the far wall. Kate retrieved my weapon off the bed, training two guns on us now. Then she shuffled back toward the doorway and gave us another command, the smart move. The one I would make if I were giving the orders. Both of you, on the bed, she said. I took the lead, sitting down on the edge of the bed. I hoped that would be enough. But again, if Kate was smart, and she was, it wouldn't satisfy her. Scooch back all the way on the bed, she said. Backs against the headboard, hands on your thighs, feet on the bed, ankles crossed. That was the smart move. Make us as immobile as possible. We couldn't rush her this way. In the time it took us to uncross our ankles, push ourselves off the bed, drop our feet down on the carpet, and make a move toward her, she'd have time to empty her magazine and probably reload. She had us completely under her control. Amy and I sitting on the bed, Kate standing at the opposite end of the small bedroom. I had nothing for a weapon other than my phone, which I put next to me on the bed. I wasn't a good enough aim to skull her with it, and even if I succeeded, it wouldn't do more than momentarily stun her. She'd recover in time to riddle me with bullets. Satisfied that we were sufficiently subdued, Kate lowered the guns in her hands. Was she a part of it too? Kate asked me, gesturing toward Amy. A part of what? I asked, though it wasn't hard to tell what she meant. The bribes, the payoffs. I know it was you, Billy. It wasn't, but I remembered what Amy had said to me. It was your name in the little black book. Somebody set me up, I said. Kate glared at me, worked her jaw. It's going to be like that, is it? Just deny everything up and down? Don't bullshit a bullshitter, I said. Don't turn this around. It was you, Kate. Her face showed no sign of anything but disgust. I trusted you, she said. I fucking loved you, Billy. With those words, her expression broke. She didn't cry, but she choked up nice and good, the fire still in her eyes, but now showing real pain. She took a deep breath and said, "You're under arrest, Billy Harney." It didn't register with me. It didn't make sense. She was going to arrest me? That's when I knew. Kate wasn't the dirty cop. If she were, I'd be dead. Amy and I both. Arresting me made no sense. I could still fight back. I could hire a lawyer and prove my innocence. I could prove that she was the dirty cop, not me. If she had been the dirty cop, she would have killed me just as she killed Ramona De La Vue and Camel Coat, whatever she needed to do to maintain her cover-up. It wasn't Amy and it wasn't Kate. And it sure as hell wasn't me. "Kate," I said, "listen." And then we all listened. We all heard it. The soft click of Amy's front door opening. Kate's head whipped to the right, surprised. Then not surprised. "What are you doing here?" she said to whoever it was. With Kate momentarily distracted, I reached for my phone, held it in my hand. Using it as a weapon felt like a million-to-one shot. But that didn't mean I couldn't use it in other ways. I heard his voice from the living room, and I dropped my phone back on the bed just before Lieutenant Mike Goldberger walked into the bedroom. 101. Kate took a step back to clear some space as Goldie walked into the room. My mouth opened, but I couldn't speak.
"Nobody's arresting anybody," he said. "We just need to talk this out."
He seemed almost amused, seeing me and Amy lying on the bed, our feet up and legs crossed. He looked at Kate.
"I'll put the guns away, for Christ's sake," he said. "This is Billy we're talking about. I'm sure he can explain this."
Kate lowered her weapon to her side. Goldie took my gun from Kate.
"That's better," he said.
He walked over to the windowsill and punched out the music on the iPad.
"That damn music," he said. "Drowned out a perfectly good recording device."
Then Goldie walked toward the bed, facing me, his back to Kate.
"So, Billy," he said, "let's figure this out."
"There's nothing to figure out," said Kate. "I'm taking him in, Goldie."
"No, you're not, Katie."
"The fuck I'm not?" Goldie looked at me. He heaved a deep sigh. Then he spun and aimed my gun at Kate. He fired a single shot. Kate had no chance to react. The bullet hit her right above the right eye. She dropped in her tracks, falling to the carpet. Amy let out a horrified gasp and reached for me. I drew her in. I didn't know what to... Goldie spun back around, probably to make sure I wasn't making a move on him. "I can't believe," I tried to say. "I can't..."
"You can't what? I'm cleaning up your mess, pal, because you wouldn't leave well enough alone."
Everything was racing through my mind, trying to fit together pieces of a puzzle that hurled at me from all directions. "It was you," I said. "You set me up. You made Kate believe it was me."
"I needed to keep Kate guessing, yeah," he said. "But I wasn't gonna let this fall on you."
He angles his head.
"I admit, I didn't expect her to come here on her own and try to arrest you. We can't have that.